This will be taken under advisement. We move to the third case today, Sharon Walker versus the Board of Regents of the University of Wisconsin.
May it please the court, my name is David Rohr, and I'm here along with my co-counsel, Joanne Curry, on behalf of the plaintiff appellant, Dr. Sharon Walker. I find it a little bit ironic here that our case is, in fact, the opposite of the case that you just heard. What brings us here today is that Dr. Walker was successful in front of the jury, and the judge granted the defendants motion for judgment as a matter of law and tossed out the jury verdict.
Well, the last plaintiff was successful in front of the jury.
On one aspect. I did pick that up. Right.
The judge here set it aside.
Right. Thank you, Your Honor. In any event, this is a case where the jury heard 3.5 days of testimony and then deliberated for about 8 hours, if my recollection is correct, and came back with a split verdict, finding for Dr. Walker on her claim that her contract was non-renewed because of her gender, but the jury rejected her claim that race was a factor in the non-renewal. And there was a third claim that her non-renewal was based on her exercise of her free speech rights. The jury on that count found that her free speech rights were indeed a factor, but that the defendants would have non-renewed her for other reasons, and therefore under Mount Healthy she was not successful on that First Amendment claim. These latter two claims are not before the court. We're here only on the gender discrimination claim on which Dr. Walker was successful. And as I indicated, the district court granted defendants motion for judgment as a matter of law and tossed out the jury verdict. Now, I'd like to start out by pointing out that in our view, the district court ignored the two basic strictures that govern motions for judgment as a matter of law. First is that the court is not entitled to reweigh the evidence. And second, the court must draw all inferences in favor of the plaintiff that support the verdict. And I'd like to point out one particular example of what we're talking about here, and that is the court's comment on pages 38 to 39 of the court's opinion. There the court said that it was not necessary to discuss the plaintiff's contention that the defendant, Chancellor Markey of the University of Wisconsin-Platteville, testified falsely in a prior proceeding about the timing of his ordering of an investigation by outside evaluators of the Office of Career Planning and Placement. On page 10 of the opinion, the court acknowledged that at trial, the defendant, Chancellor Markey, admitted that his previous testimony and averments in an affidavit had been inaccurate about the timing of this outside evaluation. So on the one hand, we have the court acknowledging that he'd given prior false testimony, but then ruling on the Rule 50 motion, saying that it was not necessary to discuss this prior false testimony. This was prior false testimony on a rather key point, and the fact that the chancellor had testified falsely in a prior proceeding was certainly evidence in favor of the plaintiff and in support of the verdict.
What was exactly his relevance?
The relevance was that one of the reasons the chancellor gave for non-renewing Dr. Walker was that she had not properly supervised the Office of Career Planning and Placement headed by Sandra Stacy. And he said that Dr. Walker and the immediate supervisor of that office, Dr. Schumacher, were at loggerheads about how effectively that office was functioning. And Chancellor Marquis testified in a personnel commission hearing and that he had ordered an outside evaluation of this in the spring of 1997. He brought in outside evaluators who supported Dr. Schumacher and basically found that Dr. Walker had not properly supervised that office. In actuality, what happened is that he didn't bring in this outside evaluation. There were two members that he brought in. He didn't do this until the spring of 1998. And he did it not because there was a dispute over how the office was functioning, but because Sandra Stacy had filed a sexual harassment complaint against her immediate supervisor, Dr. Schumacher. And other witnesses testified that they were informed that the reason the outside evaluators were coming in was because of this complaint. And Sandra Stacy had requested someone else to evaluate her because she feared retaliation. So not only is the timing a year off, but also the reasons why he brought in these outside evaluators was also something that Chancellor Marquis testified falsely about. Now, it turns out that even though Chancellor Marquis said one of the reasons he non-renewed Dr. Walker was because she had not properly evaluated the office and that was substantiated by these outside evaluators, turns out at trial we were able to show that he didn't get the report from these outside evaluators until May 13 of 1998. He non-renewed Dr. Walker on March 4, 1998. Now, the court said that this timing really didn't matter because Chancellor Marquis got periodic reports prior to May 13 and therefore was able to rely on these to conclude that Dr. Walker had not properly supervised this office. Well, that timing just doesn't make sense. These outside evaluators were appointed on February 23rd, 1998. Before the end of February, Chancellor Marquis went down and told the UW System President, Catherine Lyle, that he was intending to non-renew Dr. Walker. And on March 4, 1998, he in fact told Dr. Walker she was not going to be renewed. So
the issue is whether his opinion was supported by these outside evaluators that we're talking about.
Well, regardless of whether it was or not, he didn't have any opinion from them to rely on.
Well, he had his own opinion, I assume.
Well, he had no basis to think that, is what the testimony shows. I see I'm cutting into my, I believe that light is my rebuttal time, so I'd better save some time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. My name is Michael Lossie. I'm an assistant attorney general in the Wisconsin Department of Justice, and I, with my co-counsel Tom Stafford, UW system attorney, are here representing the defendant appellees in this case, who are the University of Wisconsin Board of Regents and Chancellor David Marquis. Subject to answering the court's questions, there's four overriding points I'd like to make. First of all, that in understanding this case, Dr. Walker's status as an at-will employee serving at the pleasure of the chancellor is very important. Second, that Dr. Walker's admissions at trial as to her refusal to do what the chancellor asked of her are determinative as to plaintiff's pretext arguments. Third, that there were a number of complaints against her, how she handled and how she related to staff, that are determinative as to plaintiffs' pretext arguments regarding Chancellor Marquis' second ground that she had an adverse effect on morale in her division. And fourth, I would like to answer some of plaintiffs' specific points. I'll start with my fourth point insofar as dealing with what plaintiff has raised at her oral argument. The evidence does not show anything suspicious as to timing or suggestive of pretext. Now, what There, Chancellor Markey indicated that there was a third factor in his decision not to renew Dr. Walker, and that third factor was her failure to adequately take charge of the Office of Career Planning and Placement, which was run by Sandra Stacey, and which was described as dysfunctional and the subject of a lot of complaints by professors on campus that had to use it to place their students. What the evidence in at this trial showed is that Chancellor Markey was aware of this at least by fall of 1997. He, at about that time, asked Sharon Walker to reevaluate Sandra Stacey, because in the past, Dr. Walker had given Sandra Stacey a very high evaluation and found that her office was running just fine. Dr. Walker refused, and she doesn't deny this assertion. She said, "It's Richard Schumacher, one of my subordinates' jobs to deal with it. I'm not going to get involved." So she point-blank refused to help Richard Schumacher when he came to her, and she refused the chancellor. This was in 97. It was at the end of 97 that Dr. Schumacher made some inopportune remarks to Sandra Stacey to try to motivate them. They're in the briefs. There's something like, "Hitch up your girdle and bust your buns and get to work and do something." Sandra Stacey complained. There was an informal hearing held where he apologized and said he would never do that again. She accepted his apology and said, "Fine, I just don't want him doing my evaluation." Now, it is true that then in February, Chancellor Markey officially convenes an investigation of the Office of Career Planning and Placement, which also will then do its own evaluation of Sandra Stacey and keep Dean Richard Schumacher out of it. That did, and the letter informing Sharon Walker of this was February 24th, 1997. That's true. However, the trial transcript is replete with evidence, and the district court so found that Chancellor Markey was aware of these problems because it was an issue on campus. It's how bad this office was before Sandra Stacey said anything. But it was after Sandra Stacey's complaint about Richard Schumacher that he did formally convene Mr. Zielke and Ms. Paul to do a formal evaluation. The chancellor did not testify falsely. There is no evidence that he testified falsely in the Personnel Commission. There is evidence he made a mistake, and there's a difference between the two. His information was inaccurate at the Personnel Commission. Whether it was a deliberate lie is a second question, and we submit there's simply no evidence of this, and it's Chancellor Markey himself who corrected the erroneous information in his summary judgment affidavit in this case in the federal court. And moreover, the discrepancy is significant. Dr. Walker has a right to raise it. But the discrepancy was that in the Personnel Commission, he said he relied in part upon the written report from Zielke and Paul, whereas when he corrected his testimony and the way he testified at trial was that, no, the written report wasn't done until May, but he did get information from them all the way along. That's undisputed, that he had information and feedback from them from the get-go, and that he had talked to them prior to February 24th, because that February 24th is only the date when the letter goes out to tell Dr. Walker, "If you won't do it, I'm going to have somebody else do it." In short, I don't believe this is a significant issue. Dr. Walker served at will and at the pleasure of the chancellor. This is very important because it means that he could non-renew her for any reason or no reason, so long as it wasn't discriminatory. This is not disputed. And that would include non-renewing her for a philosophical difference. It's also undisputed that this is crucial to a chancellor. Dr. Walker was one of four assistant chancellors. They were the main people who managed the institution. If the chancellor doesn't have the full support on a philosophical level and in terms of acting, he's utterly sabotaged from doing what he's trying to do. And it was also undisputed in this case that Chancellor Markey came with a mandate to change the status quo at this campus because it was ailing. He did not simply replace a retiring chancellor. He came to try to correct problems with enrollment, with morale and with relationships with the community. He had a mandate. Now, Dr. Walker at trial freely admitted that, yes, he had this mandate, and the mandate was to change the status quo, that she was part of the status quo, and that made her feel defensive and apprehensive, and she didn't do what he wanted. Dr. Walker's admissions at trial, I think, are extremely important. That's the one thing I want to drive home. She claims that, takes the position in her briefing that she didn't have notice of him wanting her to be involved with enrollment management or upper echelon recruiting, but yet she admits in her testimony that as early as September of 1996, he was talking to her about it. She also states that as early as December 97, he told her he was considering not renewing her and that he wanted her to do something with recruiting, and she said, "I'm not interested in being a recruiter." She didn't follow up and say, "What do you want me to do?" Most importantly, we have these two memos. January 8th, Chancellor Marquis writes a memo to her basically giving her an edict. "You're going to do this." She responds January 16th and says, "In effect, court can read it for itself, no I won't." In her briefing, Dr. Marquis tries to say that Dr. Walker tries to say that her use of the word "I'm in philosophical agreement with Chancellor Marquis" did not mean she wouldn't become involved with recruiting at a high level, merely that she was philosophically opposed to him telling her to cut down the number of direct reports, cut down the number of time you spend on meetings so you can be doing what I want you to do. Let your subordinates do the day-to-day management. But yet, at trial, she admitted that she was philosophically opposed to this whole idea of her being involved in going off campus for anything. She said that in terms of explaining her memo, she said that his point in his memo, establishing relationships with the community, region, and public schools, that was of the greatest concern for me. By the way, this is at volume 2A of the trial transcript, pages 29 to 31. She said, Richard Schumacher is responsible for making those questions. She questions whether it's a good use of her time. And she said she has no objection to doing certain things regarding recruitment. Dr. Walker, in her briefing, plays this up to say she didn't really refuse. She just didn't know what to do and wanted to do something else. But at trial, what she actually admitted was that her responsibility in her mind and the only thing she's willing to do is to supervise the Department of Admissions on campus, to have some responsibilities on campus. But she says, "But I didn't see it as my role to visit high schools." It is also in the record that on January 23rd, Chancellor met with her and said, "Do you know what this means?" And she said, "Yes, I do know what it means." She also testified that within a week she got two memos talking about activities going on at Milwaukee high schools. She testified that she interpreted this as him wanting her to visit some high schools. This is her last chance. She knows it. She has time. He tells her when to go. And she said she never visited any. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. How much time? You have 2 minutes.
I'd like to respond to a few of the points that Mr. Lossie made, and I'll try to do them quickly. I don't believe Mr. Lossie's correct that Dr. Walker admitted at trial that she was asked to go in and reevaluate Sandra Stacy. She testified that she was never asked to go in and reevaluate Sandra Stacy. That's a discrepancy in the testimony. The jury was entitled to believe Dr. Walker, and it did. Now, as far as her refusing to do what the chancellor asked, the testimony was that in December of 1997 was the first time when they met in mid-December, it was the first time that the chancellor asked Dr. Walker to do anything with recruitment. Now, he claimed that he'd been doing this ever since he got there, and that was not true. Dr. Walker testified it was December of 1997. And even then, at that meeting, he said, "We're not getting along. I want you to do something with recruitment. I'm not sure what yet." He still wasn't clear at that time. So then he writes this January 8th memo to her about establishing key relationships with high schools and so forth, which is not a model of clarity. As a matter of fact, Chancellor Marquis said that Dr. Walker's replacement, Mick Viney, he himself was not even sure, after he replaced Dr. Walker, what Marquis wanted in the way of recruitment activities. Now, as to the importance of this whole thing, the court in prior cases has said that even though an employer may set clear expectations, if in fact those expectations are set as a pretext for discrimination, that can be relevant evidence. The fact is that Mick Viney, in the 18 months, the first 18 months that he served as assistant chancellor as Walker's replacement, went to visit high schools once or twice. Yet Marquis claimed at trial that he expected Dr. Walker to go out and visit high schools once or twice a week. This was clearly unequal treatment in the way he expected her to perform. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thanks to both sides. The case will be taken under advisement.